Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Hussein Ibish, Executive Director of the Foundation for Arab American Leadership, who discusses the results of Iraq's October 15th constitutional referendum. Constitutional Attorney John Boniface, who examines the investigation into the White House disclosure of a CIA agent's identity and the possible implication of President Bush in more serious crimes related to the Iraq War. And Alex Wilson, executive editor of Environmental Building News, who discusses a plan for rebuilding New Orleans using 21st century environmentally sustainable construction techniques. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Pressure is building to delay Haiti's upcoming election. Voter registration has fallen far short of expectations, and groups like the Catholic Church's Peace and Justice Commission and Grassroots International question the fairness of the process. The U.S.-installed interim government in Haiti has delayed the election twice, and the new date is set for sometime in December. Already, 32 candidates for president have started campaigning. According to a study by the International Crisis Group, only 870,000 Haitians out of a potential 4 million have registered to vote. The election board has had trouble distributing voter ID cards, recruiting election workers, and preparing ballots. According to the news service OneWorld.net, supporters of the Lavalas Family Party of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide say their presidential candidate, Father Gerard Jean-Just, was excluded from the ballot. Father Just was arrested in July on what Charles Arthur of the UK-based Haiti Support Group insists is a dubious charge of possessing illegal guns. Meanwhile, a team from the United Nations Human Rights Commission decried a catastrophic situation in Haiti, with acts of arbitrary arrest, torture, and summary executions by the Haitian National Police. The Village Voice reports a Marine Corps recruiter, Gunnery Sergeant Hubert Lucas, was convicted in a military court of providing false documents to undocumented immigrants so they could enlist in the military. Lucas was found guilty of fraudulent enlistment, conspiracy, dereliction of duty, and improper fraternization with an applicant before a military panel on Parris Island, South Carolina. At the trial, Lucas did not dispute the fact that enlistees had used counterfeit documents, but insisted that there was no evidence he had provided them. In August 2004, Lucas and three other recruiters became targets of a Navy criminal investigation for their work at the recruiting station in Perrine, Florida. The probe identified 23 recruits who used fraudulent documents like counterfeit green cards and Social Security numbers to enlist in the Marine Corps. During the time of the investigation, from 2002 to 2004, the Marine Corps exceeded its recruiting goals at the station, and Lucas received a productivity rating of above average. Two Indian tribes in Connecticut are considering their next move after a mid-October ruling by the Bureau of Indian Affairs reversed a decision granting them federal recognition. The BIA had granted federal recognition to the Eastern Pequots and to the Shattuck tribes in 2004. Shattuck Tribal Chairman Richard Velke says that the costs of pursuing federal recognition often force tribes to ally themselves with outside interests they might prefer not to deal with, and those are most often gambling interests. Velke says politicians need to separate the issue of federal recognition and gaming. The Interior Department ruled the tribes did not qualify for federal recognition because they could not prove they had existed as a tribe through the centuries, forming an intact cultural and social community. The tribes vehemently disagree, and the Shattuck say they will appeal the decision in federal court. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Melinda Tuhus. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
The October 15th referendum on Iraq's proposed constitution went forward with a lower level of violence than predicted. Despite a recent escalation of attacks by anti-occupation insurgents, there were relatively few strikes on military and civilian targets on the day of the Iraqi election. After hearing initial reports that voter participation may have been higher than last January's legislative election and opponents failed to defeat approval of the Constitution, President Bush praised the vote as a sign that Iraqis want to settle their disputes peacefully. But 2 days after counting ballots, the Independent Election Commission of Iraq said that they were investigating unusually high vote totals in 12 Shiite and Kurdish provinces, where in some cases, 99% of the votes were cast in favor of the draft constitution. Prominent leaders of Iraq's Sunni minority, who largely oppose the constitution, were quick to assert that the irregular vote tally may indicate fraud, calling into question the referendum's credibility. Despite last-minute negotiations to appease the Sunni voters by offering a chance to amend the constitution at a later date, early election results show most Sunnis opposed the charter. One of the most contentious provisions of the document on the minds of opponents was a fear that the sanction of autonomous zones in the oil-rich Kurdish north and a similar zone in the Shiite south would lead to a breakup of the nation. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hussein Ibish, executive director of the Hala Maqsood Foundation for Arab American Leadership. He discusses the results of Iraq's constitutional referendum and how it may affect the war and the timetable for a U.S. withdrawal.
There was really never any doubt that the constitution was going to survive. I mean, I think, in other words, the test that was built in, a two-thirds supermajority in three provinces, was never something that the organized Iraqi Sunni community, such as it is, and let's remember that unlike the Shiite fundamentalist groups and the Kurdish nationalist groups, who both have a very long-standing pre-existing political organizations that long predate the occupation and the new situation, you know, following the invasion, that the Iraqi Sunni community has no such thing, has no such organizations, that really they were never going to be able to do that, particularly given the number of Shiites and Kurds who live in Baghdad province. So, you know, this really, I think, was always going to pass. Plus, it looks like there was additionally shenanigans. And then the thing is, this is Schubert's unfinished constitution. I mean, it's missing big sections that everyone agrees needed to be there. There were things they couldn't agree upon, so they just left them out. And, you know, even if they had addressed everything they set out to address, which they didn't, it still, you know, leaves 1,001 questions unanswered. It's a very rudimentary, very vague document that could be interpreted in a lot of different ways.
With preliminary vote results showing that many Sunnis voted against this constitution, sure, does approval of this charter portend the eventual breakup of Iraq into three distinct autonomous zones, or maybe in the future separate states?
There are more elements that would tend, I think, ultimately to scenarios that are violent and possibly that sunder Iraq than that lead to reconciliation and democracy and compromise. There are basically four scenarios that can happen here. The first is, you know, what the president tells us is happening, that Iraqis will work out slowly their political system by compromise, by elections and plebiscites and writing constitutions and drafting and redrafting and, you know, the political system, and that the insurgency will sort of burn itself out. Sunnis will be brought slowly into the political process. They'll develop their political post-Ba'athist political parties, and over, you know, 5-6 years will be brought in, and then the Iraqis will come together and kick out the fringe foreign jihadists led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and what have you. And those people will be gone, and Iraq will basically become a model pluralistic, you know, democracy in the Middle East. So that's scenario one, and I have to say there just isn't a lot of evidence for that. Scenario number two would be that for the next sort of, 5 to 10 years, Iraq basically hobbles along as it is. No major change. Scenario three would be, you know, a gradual reduction of the Western presence and a transition into a situation where one group or coalition of groups, probably a coalition of Shiite fundamentalist and Kurdish nationalist forces, the same groups that dominate the parliament, you know, would join together to violently, and I mean very violently, with extreme violence, impose their order, which is reflected in this constitution, where Kurds get their super autonomy in the north and Shiites get their quasi-theocracy in the rest of the country. The last scenario, scenario four, would be the same thing, an attempt to do that. The West getting out, you know, the U.S. basically getting out, making way for a wider conflict where a coalition of Shiites and Kurds confront the Sunnis and any secular Shiites. And rather than winning, as scenario three sort of posits, the whole thing descends into a giant chaos, and that it tends towards the breakup of the country and a descent into complete and total anarchy. Frankly, many of the signs lead in that kind of direction. I really, really wish that I could say otherwise, but I don't think I can.
The Bush administration says they're going to stay the course in Iraq. They're going to remain there with the U.S. troops until victory is won. At the same time, political realities are the Republicans are on the defensive. Right. Their poll numbers are horrendous, and they're going into a midterm election in November 2006. What prospect do you see that the U.S. is going to draw down the number of troops there by the November 2006 election?
I just don't think, as a political matter, it's plausible. Even if every Iraqi wanted us gone, and even if every American wanted to get out, I really don't think we can. I think it would be an incredible blow to the sense of power and prestige of the United States. I think, you know, we're stuck there. And I think it would sentence Iraq to an immediate and horrendous civil conflict that would be also unconscionable. We really have trapped ourselves into a situation where we just don't have any good options, and we don't have much control over the situation, and we don't know what we're doing.
That was Hussein Ibish, Executive Director of the Hala Maqsood Foundation for Arab American Leadership. Contact the group by visiting their website at www.halafoundation.org. The federal probe into who in the White House leaked the identity of a covert CIA agent to news reporters is drawing to a close. During his investigation, Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald questioned President Bush's senior advisor Karl Rove four times, confirming, despite early public denials, that he was at least one of those in the White House who revealed the identity of the CIA officer. Fitzgerald also succeeded in pressuring reluctant Time reporter Matt Cooper and the New York Times' Judith Miller to testify before the grand jury hearing the case. Although Miller initially refused to testify and was jailed on contempt charges for 85 days, she recently changed her mind and made a deal with Fitzgerald to be released after agreeing to speak before the grand jury. In Miller's own account of her testimony published in the Times, she confirms along with Cooper that Lewis Scooter Libby, a senior advisor to Vice President Cheney, was a source from whom she had received information about the identity of undercover CIA operative Valerie Plame. Plame is the wife of former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who had publicly debunked President Bush's pre-war declaration that Saddam Hussein was attempting to obtain uranium from the African nation of Niger for an Iraqi nuclear weapons program. As the nation awaits the conclusion of Fitzgerald's case, which could end in the indictment of Rove or Libby on charges of violating the Espionage Act or perjury, more important aspects of this affair are being overlooked by much of the corporate media. Central to the case is the Bush administration's use of dubious evidence to justify the Iraq War. The subsequent outing of CIA agent Plame appears to have been part of a larger White House effort to silence and punish the president's critics. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Boniface, constitutional attorney and co-founder of the group AfterDowningStreet.org, who explains why he believes this investigation must be broadened to include the false pretext under which the nation went to war with Iraq and the impeachable offenses that may have been committed by President Bush.
I do think that we need to get to the broader question of why this outing occurred, and the why gets us to the underlying lies and deception that the administration told the country and the Congress with respect to this war. Valerie Plame's husband, as we know, Ambassador Joe Wilson, came forward in July of 2003 with very clear evidence that the administration had hyped the case for war and had stated wrongly and untruthfully that Niger had tried to sell uranium to Iraq, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which was a major basis for the administration's case for taking the nation into war. Once Ambassador Wilson came forward with that evidence, the White House scrambled to do whatever it could to discredit him, went after his wife, and they did so because they saw their own cover-up of their lies and deception unraveling. And now we see, 2 years later, the results of that kind of conduct. And in fact, it may result in indictments in federal court, and I think it may result in the further unraveling of this administration.
What are the connections that you see between the Valerie Plame disclosure case now being investigated and the revelations made in the infamous Downing Street memo for which your organization is named?
Well, they're directly linked because the Downing Street memo, the July 23, 2002 memo, which is really consists of minutes of an official meeting that occurred at 10 Downing Street in London, the Prime Minister's residence, where he heard a briefing from Sir Richard Dearlove, the senior British intelligence officer, that included the notation in the minutes that the President of the United States had decided already by that time, summer of 2002, to invade Iraq and to fix the intelligence around the policy. Now, if the intelligence was in fact being fixed, as these minutes revealed, then that would directly correspond with what Ambassador Wilson said on the op-ed pages of the New York Times in July of 2003 when he came forward with the evidence that he went to Niger, he investigated whether uranium had been sold to Iraq, and he found it all to be false. And yet the President himself and other members of the administration hyped the case for war based on that claim that uranium had been sold to Iraq. So it's directly linked with what we learned from the Downing Street minutes, and it really does raise the larger question of whether the President and top administration officials have engaged in a conspiracy to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for going to war against Iraq. And if they did, I can think of no higher crime for a president to commit than to send this nation off into war based on potential lies. And that's why at AfterDowningStreet.org, we are continuing to press for an investigation into whether or not the president has committed impeachable offenses in connection with the Iraq war.
What is the likelihood, do you think, if there are indictments in the Valerie Plame case of Karl Rove or others in the White House, that those indictments may set off an environment in this country where an impeachment would be possible? Because right now, many political pragmatists look at that and think it's far-fetched.
Well, first, AfterDowningStreet.org just recently commissioned a poll from a reputable polling firm that demonstrated that 50% of Americans agree that the president should be impeached if it's shown that he lied to the nation, to the Congress, about the basis for taking this nation to war. Those numbers are far, far higher than any numbers that appeared at the height of the Clinton impeachment scandal, and they demonstrate that the public is far ahead of leaders in Washington on this question. I think what the indictments could very well do if they come forward is they could finally serve as the bridge between where the public is in demanding accountability and demanding answers and where Washington has failed to carry out its duty. And I think that if we in fact see Karl Rove or Scooter Libby or others in the White House administration indicted, we're going to see more courage and more leadership coming from Washington by those who are willing to stand up and demand accountability from this administration.
John Bonifaz, what is the most promising line of inquiry that you can point to that could reveal a smoking gun in terms of the Bush administration's collective knowledge about the false premise upon which the Iraq war was launched?
Well, of course, our position has been since May of this year that the Downing Street memo provided that smoking gun and that Congress needed nothing more than that to launch a full investigation. However, I do think what could very well happen out of the Patrick Fitzgerald investigation with respect to Valerie Plame and the outing of her identity is we could see, if indictments go forward, a court process that further reveals the falsehoods that the Bush administration put forth to the nation, to Congress. And it could in fact, become a broadened investigation to the other potential crimes the administration committed in connection with the outing of Valerie Plame. So I think that we don't know fully all of the potential documents that are out there, the whistleblowers that will be willing to come forward, the testimony that would happen under oath in those kinds of cases. We don't know fully, but we do have enough to go on with the Downing Street memo, with Ambassador Wilson's op-ed, and with what happened to Valerie Plame, to know that this is a far, far deeper scandal than the public has even been able to fully become aware of. And time will only tell, you know, how this administration comes out of it. But I think that the fact is the writing's on the wall here. In essence, in history, it will be seen as the most reckless, or at least one of the most reckless administration in our nation's history.
That was John Boniface, constitutional attorney and co-founder of the group After DowningStreet.org, pressing to investigate the British Downing Street memos. Visit his group's website at www.afterdowningstreet.org. As New Orleans continues its slow recovery from the destruction of Hurricane Katrina, residents are dealing with hundreds of thousands of damaged buildings and mountains of trash. The mold growing everywhere poses a serious health problem, and the debris is smelly, unsightly, and in some cases, toxic. The first priority of many residents, city, state, and federal officials is to get rid of the trash, wipe the slate clean, and start over. But some people and organizations are proposing another route to cleanup, one that separates toxic trash from usable building materials, allowing for reuse of those materials to rebuild the damaged city. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alex Wilson, executive editor of Environmental Building News, based in Brattleboro, Vermont. In consultation with others in the green building movement, he published a 10-point plan for rebuilding New Orleans. The plan includes proposals for repairing the levees while restoring the floodplain, but focuses much attention on the buildings themselves and making New Orleans a model of 21st century construction. Wilson developed his plan based on the assumption that New Orleans will be rebuilt in its present site, despite the city's vulnerable location.
One of the recommendations to happen right away, should have happened already, would be to establish enterprise zone businesses in New Orleans to salvage and warehouse building materials that are going to be coming out of the homes that were destroyed through Hurricane Katrina. And we'd love to see those homes, at least many of those homes, deconstructed rather than simply torn down with bulldozers. Deconstructed in a way that the materials in those homes can be salvaged, warehoused, cleaned up, and used later in the reconstruction of homes in the city.
But so many of those buildings are so full of mold and other disgusting things that to clean it up would be such a Herculean task and maybe not even possible. Or are you talking about other kinds of materials?
There's an entire range of materials and products, and indeed many of the homes and many of the wood-based materials are damaged beyond salvage, particularly from the mold that is now infused throughout the material. But there are other materials that can be salvaged. You know, it might be brick, it might be stone mantelpieces from older buildings. There's a whole range of materials that we felt could be salvaged and cleaned up. We felt that there was opportunity there to, collect some of these resources, which are otherwise just going to fill up landfills and fill up a lot of landfills.
Doing that would also provide a lot more hours of work for people, right, than just bulldozing everything.
We looked at this as really a way to create local ownership of commerce. Create businesses that were locally owned, cooperatively owned, that hired local people, put them back to work in a productive way and got some money flowing into the economy again.
Another of your points is to mandate or incentivize green building, which is building that is environmentally friendly and energy efficient. There are hardly any green buildings in the entire country now, right?
That's correct. There are, you know, a few hundred that have gone through the LEED certification system. LEED is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, a program of the U.S. Green Building Council. The point is that a lot of taxpayer money is going into the rebuilding efforts, a huge amount of taxpayer money, and we should be looking at the big picture of the buildings that are going to be built through that investment of taxpayer support. And we should be creating buildings that are going to be healthy for the environment, healthy for people to live in, and durable, so that we're not coming back in 10 years and rebuilding them because of mold problems or moisture management problems. And one of the best ways to ensure that is to insist that buildings go through some sort of certification program. And for public buildings, we've recommended that these buildings go through the LEED certification system.
Have you done any outreach to people working at the grassroots level in New Orleans to see what they think of these ideas? I've spoken to the environmental justice organizer for the Sierra Club in New Orleans and also to a representative of ACORN, which works with low-income people on issues mostly of jobs and affordable housing. And some of the things they said overlapped with your proposals.
We haven't done as much of that as we would like to. Our company is also hosting a listserv about rebuilding after Katrina that's been organized by the Department of Energy and several other sustainability proponents. And through that listserv, which has significant participation from the New Orleans area, we do know that these ideas are getting into the discussions of some of the groups that are focused on the rebuilding effort in that region.
That was Alex Wilson, executive editor of Environmental Building News. For more information, call Building Green at area code 802-257-7300. Or visit their website at www.buildinggreen.com, where the entire 10-point reconstruction plan is posted. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.